In nearly all cases with modern health systems, you're waiting months for appointments only to spend a mere 10 minutes with a doctor who quickly hands out a generic diagnosis that is likely rooted in a total misunderstanding of health and causes, and then you're offered a one-size-fits-all medication or invasive treatments with unpleasant side effects. If this sounds all too familiar, consider a different approach with the New Biology Clinic, founded by Dr. Tom Cowan, a respected natural health doctor, author, and speaker. Dr. Cowan's holistic perspective on health and wellness and a deep understanding of the true nature of health and disease sets this clinic apart. With the New Biology Clinic, it's not about quick fixes and suppressing symptoms. The practitioners take time to understand your unique story, recognizing that health is unique to the individual and that illnesses have a variety of causes, physically and metaphysically. Members of the New Biology Clinic enjoy a flat monthly fee that includes a range of valuable services like health consults as needed, practitioner-led live streams on diverse health topics, access to a members-only resource library, and multiple live group sessions every month. These sessions cover fitness, breathing integration, biofield tuning, guided meditation, EFT tapping, and much more. Unlike traditional healthcare systems that thrive on frequent visits, prescriptions, treatments, and suppressing symptoms, the New Biology Clinic's motivation is to make you healthy and keep you that way. Visit newbiologyclinic.com to learn more and use code THEWAYFORWARD for $50 off your account activation. If you're a member of The Way Forward, email hello@thewayforward.com to receive $150 off your account activation. Your journey to genuine healing begins here. This episode is called The Most Important Project of the Century, and that may sound like a really bold statement, but I promise if you listen to or watch this episode in full, you will find that it's not an exaggeration. It really might be the most important project of the century. And for me, because the whole COVID nonsense and the failed germ hypothesis is something that is near and dear to my heart and something I'm very passionate about, this project really is the most important project of the century in my mind. And for those of you who may be skeptical of that, again, please listen to or watch this episode in full to understand why I'm saying that. I've shared this a lot, and I shared this at the beginning of this episode, and I'll just reiterate it briefly here. If we want the medical tyranny to end, if we want to ensure that the medical tyranny is at the very least minimized in the future, we need to be whacking down the root of the tree rather than whacking at the branches of the ever-growing tree. And the root is virology. And that's what we discussed during this episode, a project that is taking the work of Stefan Lanka and others and expanding upon it in a very incredible way, really holding virology's feet to the fire and taking the foundational so-called, quote, evidence of virology and showing that it is total nonsense. And just in the preliminary results that we discuss during this episode in the second half, you will find that it is truly incredible and really the first of its kind, total smackdown of virology. And in order to continue with this project and do phases 3 and 4, we need to help these guys who are spearheading this project get funding. You can find more info about that in the show notes. Now, the first half of this podcast episode, we also discuss the bird flu nonsense that is going around. And I don't mean that there is actually bird flu going around. There is nonsense and narratives that are very fear-based regarding bird flu that are going around. And we discussed that in the first half, especially because it relates directly to the project, sort of indicating the importance of this project, especially at this point in time. So I'll stop talking for now so you can go ahead and listen to or watch this episode. And I actually recommend watching this episode if you can. If you can't, we do our best to narrate exactly what is being shown on screen. And what will be shown to you during this episode is a total smackdown of virology. And I'm so excited to see where this project goes and so honored to be supporting it with The Way Forward. So again, if you'd like to support this project, please head to the show notes where you can find out how to get involved and how to help support this project to make sure that we end medical tyranny once and for all. In a number of presentations and interviews that I've done, I've discussed the importance of dispelling the virology myth. And I met with a lot of people saying to me, Alec, why can't we just discuss the importance of medical tyranny and dissolving that and getting rid of mandatory vaccinations, et cetera, why should we even focus on whether there's a virus or not? And I've actually used bird flu as my exact example for why it is so important that we dispel the pseudoscience of virology and just get it completely out of the way, attack the root rather than hacking at the branches of the tree. And the example that I use is, let's say a bunch of chickens on some farm somewhere start getting sick. So they decide to test these chickens for, quote, known viral illnesses. And these chickens come up negative for, quote, known viral illnesses. They already presuppose that the health issues for these chickens must be caused by a virus. And these chickens test negative for these viruses, right? These, quote, known viral illnesses. So what do? They take this sample from these chickens and send them off to a lab to use some, quote, sophisticated sequencing technology in order to determine what, quote, new virus might be popping up in these chickens. Voila, they have assembled a genome of a new virus. It's a mutation, or it's a new type of bird flu, right? They then take that new sequence and distribute it to labs across the world. And now those labs are testing chickens in those areas for, quote, known viral illnesses. Oh, then they distribute them to labs that are testing human samples. And these human beings are now testing positive for this new variation of bird flu. And then suddenly, in a matter of days, we have a worldwide pandemic on our hands. And if you are attacking the vaccine paradigm, but refusing to look at the root that is virology, you are leaving this example to occur in real time as it is now. And it will continue and continue and continue, especially as they continue to add layers and layers of what is, you know, seemingly sophisticated technologies and new paradigms and new emerging fields that are on top of the field of virology. This is going to continue unless we attack the root. Yes, it's important to focus on the pseudoscience of vaccines. Yes, it's important to fight medical tyranny. Yes, it's important to combat any of the disinformation coming from the government related to health. But it's most important that we attack the foundation, because the foundation is entirely pseudoscientific, unproven, and really an argument could be made, a very strong argument could be made at this point, that it is entirely disproven. So with that, that's why we're doing this episode. We have something really, really incredible to share in the latter half of this episode. But for the first half, we're going to discuss the so-called scientific evidence that bird flu even exists in the first place. So I'll turn it over to Jacob Diaz, also known as the undercover virologist, to describe the isolation of I think H5N1. I'm honestly not even paying attention at this point. It might be H1N1. I'm not really sure. I've just written off all of that as nonsense. So Jacob still pays attention quite a bit. So I'll turn it over to him to describe what's going on with this whole bird flu nonsense.
No, absolutely. Great alley-oop, Alec. I appreciate that. H5N1, H7N1. I mean, they have a bunch of variants of the same virus that doesn't exist. I just finished actually a post that I posted today about the whole bird flu, you know, ideology and how they're really pushing it now as the next pandemic. I was grateful that Mike Stone and Sam Bailey and Virus Mania really provided great information for me to make the post. But essentially what we have here, the same thing with COVID, the same thing with HIV, is you take these symptoms that are nonspecific that many organisms face, and then you make it so that it's a specific disease so that you can make a vaccine to it. And it leads perfectly with what you said. You have people that are always anti-medicine, anti-vaccine, safer vaccines. You know, I hate that expression, because without a virus, you don't need a vaccine. Without a germ-causing disease, you don't need a shot. So we really have to get to the root. So the root here is, in this case, birds getting sick. And I have my slides here that I'm using as reference, but I'm not going to, you know, talk too much about it. We have sick birds. And in this case, many of these birds that are being sick are being grown in factory farms. And these factory farms, and one thing that vegans do have very right, is that these birds are not being treated well at all. They're falling ill left and right. They're being fed industrial genetically modified cornmeal to get them really fat so that they can lay more eggs. They get really lazy. They're not getting sunlight at all. They're not eating grass. They're getting mistreated. They're getting walked all over on by whoever's on the farm. They're in really tight corners with a bunch of other chickens. We're talking hundreds of thousands of chickens per farm, potentially millions of chickens per farm, that are just in these small cages, not getting sunlight, eating crappy food. And then in these factories, the air itself is very toxic. It's very dirty. You have a lot of dust. On top of that, bird poop creates ammonia, which is toxic. So they're breathing that in all the time. And, you know, they're just not in a good environment. They're, again, the garbage food and not going outside and the urine and the feces. And they're being bombarded by LED light. So where in that do you think a virus is going to be causing disease when
There's also they're pumped with hormones, antibiotics. Pumped with vaccines. Exactly. They are pumped with a bunch of toxins on top of everything that you just said.
Exactly. And a lot of those are preventative as well, because these birds are not vomiting any blood or anything. There's no symptoms there. They're not healthy, but many of these antibiotics are given preventatively to prevent diseases from ever occurring. But what they don't know is all of these medicines are very, again, toxic, acidifying the tissues, destroying the microbiome. So all these birds are just not well. On top of that, you have the constant overbreeding, and these overbreeding mechanisms lead to birds that end up growing kind of oddly. There's too much breast meat in a younger age, or they have weak bones. So they're not getting good physical outcomes from these birds. On top of the vaccines, on top of the antibiotics, on top of the crappy environment they're in, that is why the birds are sick. And for the birds that are being found, you know, dead on the beach or whatnot, you then have the other factors of many of these birds live in highly populated human environments. So they're being exposed to the same stuff we're exposed to, and they're a lot smaller than us. So the same EMF, the same chemtrails, they're flying right through, much closer to the air than we are, the sky at least. They're eating the garbage that we throw out, and all of that accumulates obviously in their environment. They're usually, you know, chilling in their lakes and waterbeds or whatnot, and all that trash builds up and they're living there. And then when they die, they want to claim that there's a virus. And what's funny here is that all of these symptoms that they say are specific to bird flu are really just non-specific symptoms of any other influenza that humans would be affected by. So you have sneezing, you have discharge of the eyes, you may have diarrhea, difficulty breathing, stuff like that, fever. But then you have the specific bird-related symptoms where there's ruffled fur, or there's a dull coat, there's a blue-like color on their feathers, or they start picking at their bodies. That actually leads to a form of cannibalism, which is crazy that they do that, but that shows you how sick that they have become from the environment that we created. And one of the studies that I hope people keep up with, this because this is a study that was shown as proof that H5N1, I believe this was pathogenic. So they were trying to prove that birds can pass this supposed virus to other birds, and it's PMID 1603014, whoever wants to look
it
up.
We'll throw that in the show notes.
Yeah. In the study, they took, obviously, we all know about the cell culture stuff, which we'll get into later, but essentially they just take fluid and they just, put it in a cell line or whatnot, or inject it into an egg. And they take this runoff and then injected this toxic runoff into the digestive system and the tracheas and the mouths of baby ducks. These ducks were like 4 to 6 weeks old. And then they put two ducks in the cage that weren't inoculated with the cell culture, but they still had the same environment. They still had the same food and water and whatnot. They were still the same age. They would run sequencing, not the whole genome at this point. They were just running for like tiny sequences with their samples and isolations from the eggs that were being laid from the ducks. They would then inoculate this stuff directly into the ducks, again, unpurified garbage. And they use a total of 14 different isolates, which they call viruses, but it's just essentially 14 different cultures that are being injected into birds. And even they take some from humans as well. Humans with supposed influenza, they'll take that, grow it in a culture, and then inject it into a poor duck. The duck is, you know, barely a pound or two at this point. Very small, very weak, and you're injecting it with fluid of unknown provenance. So to test the pathogenic effect of the virus, they would look for symptoms in the ducks that were obviously injected, as well as the ducks that were living in the same cage. So they used in this study 28 ducks. 28 ducks were inoculated, so given the virus in question, in groups of two. Out of these inoculated ducks, six died. Six. So six out of 28 ducks died. That's not very, you know, pathogenic, if I'm saying so, because a lot of them didn't die. Many of them didn't even develop symptoms. Some of the contact ducks also died. So five out of 28 of the contact ducks died. So this kind of begs the question, how in the world does this study prove that this bird flu is so pathogenic and so deadly that only six of the 28 ducks that were injected with fluid directly into their bodies died and the others didn't? And in the study, when it goes further, they say that there were non-specific, you know, effects, some symptoms that were inconsistent, some ducks didn't have any symptoms. So again, it's virology mixing the or fudging the results, really. And then on their title, they say bird flu pathogenic. But then when you read and get to the actual details, none of that really happened. Of course, some animals died. I mean, you're injecting unpurified gunk in it. But again, Sam Bailey brought this up in her video. No controls whatsoever, nothing. There were no controls done in this experiment, nullifying it as a scientific experiment. First off, there was no independent variable. We know this. There was no virus there. They just took stuff. And then they didn't run a control experiment with fluid that was coming from a healthy person or a healthy bird or, you know, saline solution, something like that. They didn't do that. So this was not, by definition, a scientific experiment. And then what do? They run sequencing. So they try to find these sequences that they injected into the ducks. And then lo and behold, they find them. They say, oh, this sequence proves that there's a virus. And then in some of the ducks that were contact ducks, not inoculated, they found sequences. But again, sequences do not mean virus. With COVID, yeah,
these are just small fragments of genetic material of unknown provenance. That's the issue, right? Meaning unknown provenance, for those who are listening, don't know what that means, basically of unknown origin. No idea where these small fragments of genetic material are coming from. And the other thing that's interesting about what you said with this study, I'd be curious to know how many microliters of this toxic cell culture soup was injected into these baby ducks. Again, you have to think, for those that are listening or watching, what they're claiming is that this represents what happens in nature amongst birds. And again, we know that I think Mike Cardamone made an incredible video relating, you know, the CDC's quote proof that vaccines and vaccine adjuvants are safe by showing studies in which aluminum hydroxide and aluminum phosphate were ingested versus in claiming that that proves that when they're injected, that's safe. And what he said, which was a perfect, just hilarious example to show how absurd it is, yeah, that's right. That's why every morning I wake up and inject 250 microliters of broccoli directly into my bloodstream, because injecting something is identical to ingesting something. So same thing related to this idea that injecting a toxic cell culture soup, which, you know, they presuppose contains a virus. We'll get into that a little bit later. I've linked some episodes in the show notes for those that are just brand new to this and might be having their mind blown right now. But they take this cell culture soup and inject it into these baby birds. And then some of the cases in some other studies, they'll take, they won't inject it, but they'll just dump some of it down this bird's throat in an absurd quantity. And again, that doesn't represent anything that occurs in nature whatsoever. And as we've said, these birds are in an artificial environment, not fed diets that birds typically are fed.
They're under LED lights. They have possibly, not in all cases, but possibly been exposed to other experiments. They're in a perpetual state of fight or flight. They're separate of other birds, separate of their community, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The list goes on. So this does not indicate anything that's occurring in nature. And then even with that, they get what you said, 5 or 6 out of the 28 died. And, yeah. And again, they're baby ducks.
So if you can't make a baby duck dead with one of the most deadliest harmful viruses, I mean, is this something that we really have to supposedly worry about, especially since we can't, you know, freaking find it? And you mentioned it, though, the actual amount of injected stuff in the duck. They did provide it. I didn't say it in the post, but a lot of these experiments, they use these baby mice or baby ducks and then just shove a ridiculous amount of the stuff into this little baby animal. And of course it dies. I mean, you shove, you know, peanut butter into my bloodstream at a high number, I will die. That doesn't mean there's a virus in the peanut butter. Later in my research, there were, you know, other instances that occurred mainly in the thousands when really this H5N1 was taking hold that, you know, showed how ridiculous this whole thing was. In Germany, there was supposedly an H5N1 outbreak during this time. However, the inconsistencies really come up with this. So the first one was the vast majority of the birds that were found, the dead birds, were testing negative for the supposed virus. And this was supposedly an H5N1 outbreak, yet most of the birds were testing negative. Secondly, the birds did not come from any epidemic area and were actually isolated on the island off of Germany. I think it's Rügen. Am I pronouncing it wrong? My apologies. But they were on an island. Great. Yeah, man, perfect. So on an island during wintertime. So they were not, you know, traveling back and forth from an epidemic area. They were just chilling on an island and they were all found dead and all of them were negative. So how exactly could that have been a supposed viral outbreak? And then by the mid 2000s, it was said that more than supposedly, and this is really the key here with the connection with the media, the pharmaceutical system, you have these news reports saying 100 million animals have died, resulted from H5N1 from Southeast Asia. But then when you look closely, like 98% of them were killed from mass exterminations, because that's the whole thing. One or two birds test positive in an immediate area or a farm, all of the birds in the area will be killed. That's how it does. And then the media says H1N1, H5N1, whatever the heck, is killing all these birds. We need to, you know, get vaccinated, this, that, and the third. Look at the details. These birds are actually completely fine most of the time. And when they're not completely fine, it's because they're either subjected to toxins that humans are subjected to on a daily basis or in a farmland that isn't treating them right. That's pretty much it. Yet, of course, they're going to flip it and then say, you know, mass bird flu death, bird flu epidemic, and then manufacture a pandemic just like they did with COVID.
Yeah, and this is such an important point that you bring up too that I forgot to mention. That's what I always say in my examples in my presentations and podcast episodes, is that now they're culling chicken populations. Like they're literally just mass exterminating chickens. And then another possible future scenario that's not too unrealistic at this point is that the virus now jumps to cows. And they're testing cows for this. Oh, look, now we have to cull cow populations too. Point being, they're coming for the food supply and they're senselessly killing animals. So we can, you know, debate all day long on the importance of, you know, getting to the root of virology, but it's becoming crystal clear that even with this, they may not try to push a vaccine on the population. They may not try to push a vaccine on people because they already know so many people are resistant to that, but that's fine, because even if we oppose vaccines, you know, all of us on here do, there's no reason to ever receive one because there's no such thing as viruses. But point being, yeah, we can oppose vaccines all day, but if we don't attack the root of virology being totally fraudulent, okay, they won't vaccinate us. They'll just start killing the food supply, start senselessly killing animals. That's a big deal. That's a really, really big deal. And that's why I get so frustrated when people are like, oh, this is unimportant. The no virus position is a psyop. The no virus position is leading people the wrong way. The no virus position is just a minor annoyance that no one needs to pay attention to. It's just simply not true. It is the foundation for everything that occurred over the last 4 years, everything that occurred for the HIV AIDS scamdemic, everything regarding the childhood vaccine program for the CDC and all other countries. It is the foundation for much of allopathic medicine. It is extremely important that we, at the very least, question the roots of this fraudulent paradigm. And so many people are unwilling to do that. And we see a lot of people in the medical freedom space not only refusing to question it, censoring information around it, blocking and silencing those that question it, and trying to divert people away from questioning it. That's a big deal. That's
well, because
a big
the virus lie makes a lot of money. I mean, that's the realest thing I could say. I mean, there's money in perpetuating fear. And when people don't push that narrative, you're not making money off of telling people that viruses don't exist. You're actually giving the power to the person. And a lot of people don't want that to happen because then they lose their jobs. You know, it's a revolving circle. So going further, in 2005, the author, I believe, of Virus Mania, Thorsten Engelbrecht, he and his friend, I forgot his name, ran a study where they contacted the authorities that were running the whole H5N1 thing. The study was entitled Avian Flu Virus, No Proof for Existence, Pathogenicity, or Pandemic Potential, where they ask four questions very similar to what Christine Massey is asking a lot of these virus authorities. Their first question was, does H5N1 even exist? And the papers that were provided were the same papers that are provided to us, where it's just cell cultures, it's presuppositions, it's in vivo experiments, it's unpurified samples, there's no actual characterized particle there. So right then and there, it doesn't exist. Second question, is it pathogenic to humans? And at that point, there was absolutely zero, and at this point too, but there's a little more, but really zero evidence supported that any supposed particle was pathogenic, let alone to animals or humans. Just, again, poisoning animals with culture and injecting stuff and then getting effects. When they questioned the guy who actually developed this whole virus stock, Robert Webster of H5N1, they were asking him, how did you get it? What did you put in it? This, that, and the third. He did not answer them because, of course, he's not going to answer them because they're going to see right through what he's doing. Third question was, is it pathogenic to animals? Obviously, no evidence. And the fourth one, have other causes been studied? And this is a huge thing that terrain is all about. The other factors that lead to disease that are always neglected for some reason, I don't understand why. And they ask these people, are there other studies that have been done showing other possible explanations to other possibilities as to why the birds are sick? And no papers were provided. I believe out of 14 papers that were provided to like a UN group about H5N1, only one of them even mentioned other factors that can lead to bird death. But all of them were all about bird flu because that's what they're paid to talk about, bird flu. They're not talking about drugs or antibiotics or vaccines or the way chickens are treated or the EMF that the birds are subjected to or the chemtrails that are spraying directly on the birds. They're not talking about that. There's no money there. But that's what the birds are getting sick from. But then so they perpetuate the whole H5N1 to make you blind to the other factors that are leading to disease, which is why when we say in terrain, contagion is a myth, but toxicity is not a myth. That's very real, which is why we push for these people. Look at the toxicology analysis. Look at the environment. Look at the food. Look at the emotions. Look at all of that that actually leads to pathology in the body, not a particle that's never been proven to exist in the first place. It's pretty simple stuff, but people just kind of just remove it from their heads. Another study or outbreak that was provided as proof of the bird flu was a Dutch study out of Germany, H7N7, that occurred in 2003. It followed a report of health problems and high death rate in really only six poultry farms. All exports of the products were banned in surrounding countries, as well as no-go zones were put up by the military. So that's how serious this gets so quickly. You mentioned the whole idea of going after people's food, which is what I truly believe this whole thing is about. This is not an argument about diet. I don't care if you're vegan, carnivore, omnivore, whatever. They're going after the food. They already have done it with fruit and vegetables, with the pesticides, fungicides. They've already done it with the bread and the glyphosate and all that stuff. They're coming after the meat, which the whole beef thing that about the carbon and whatnot, complete BS. Now you have the chicken, which is now the bird flu. And they're also trying it with raw milk. Oh, bird flu can be in raw milk as well. So they're going after all the super healthy foods so that they can control you and then probably make you eat bugs in 10 years. That's what they want to do. But in this supposed outbreaks, They controlled the immediate area. They stopped the farmers from producing or sending out any food. And then the virus hunting people came along. PCR tests galore, antigen tests, antibody tests, which PCR, first off, not a test. We talked about it a lot. It's an amplification tool. Antigen and antibody tests are very easily manipulated in labs. I made an antibody post about it, but there's no evidence to suggest antibodies are naturally specific, let alone even proof they even exist, which is even a big rabbit hole that I'm not going to get into now. But they came along and they got their positive results, because obviously they got a positive result in a couple of birds. Following that, over the course of 4 months, 29 million chickens were killed in the Netherlands, in Germany. 29 million. This is 2003. I got other big numbers later. In 4 months, mind you, 4 months, Netherlands, Belgium, Germany, all the surrounding areas culled 29 million chickens. The media outlets, of course, as I said prior, say the virus is killing the poultry, even though they're being murdered. And how are they being murdered, you ask? Primarily, they're being gassed, and they're either, you know, gassed or lethal injection, electrocution, manual slaughter, or they're literally suffocated, where they'll raise the heat up in the farm and they'll cut off the air supply and they'll just suffocate. It's pretty gruesome. I feel bad for the chickens, honestly, but that's how they kill them. That's how they kill so many in one shot, as well as the fact that, again, very few poultry were actually tested. So if you test two or three chickens and there's 29 million of them, and then you get a positive in one of them, that's enough for them to cull an entire family of chickens. I mean, that's what's happening there.
Did they just set like an arbitrary radius of like geolocation and then say, okay, any birds within this, whatever radius based on this nonsensical model that we developed on how we think the quote virus might spread. Is that how they determine how, yeah, like what chickens?
They do it similar to what they did with COVID and contact tracing and whatnot. Oh, they have the six farms in the area. Oh, okay, the virus could have spread in this area, so we'll just block off from here to here. And the military just does the job for them. And, you know, whole communities were barricaded off by military forces. People, obviously, you know, no access to supermarkets. The farms were just closed down, leading to even more exterminations of chickens, even though one or two were really found to be ill. This costed the immediate nations around the area over 100 million euro, which is a ridiculous amount of money, in less than 4 months. In 2005, another one duck in Canada was tested for H7N7 and came back positive. However, it was claimed that it did not pose a threat to humans and was supposedly a mild virus that led to no symptoms, really no. And the duck itself was completely healthy, not sick, yet came back positive. And their response in Canada was to kill 56,000 healthy ducks and geese, which as a preventative measure, which is insane.
Insane.
Imagine going extreme here, but they did that with people. Two people test positive for COVID. All right, let's kill 2 million people just as a preventative measure. And like, it's ridiculous. Another one in 2005, an H5N1 scare occurred in Germany. A lot of these are in Germany, funny. When a few geese corpses were found along with some animals dying of severe cramps. Turns out, even after public panic, the geese had actually died from rat poison that was in the area and not from supposed H5N1. But of course, the media keeps pushed, and especially in that time period, the H5N1 propaganda. People got scared. People were quarantining, this, that, and the third, when it was just rat poison, which goes back to the whole environment, the terrain, the toxicology. What these birds are exposed to on a daily basis is going to lead to them developing disease, just like humans. But with COVID, HIV, H5N1, it's the same thing. Must be a virus. In 2005, thousands of birds in China had died near China's largest saltwater lake. However, they were not paying attention to the level of pollution in the area. It's well known, especially in China, that it has very poor air quality. And especially in the skies, they're pushing all those chemicals, especially in the chemical industry that's really bolstered up the last couple decades in China, spewing that all in the sky. And where are the birds flying? They're flying in the sky, people. So they're breathing that stuff in directly. What's going to happen when the poor air quality just gets worse and worse? All of them are going to die. And then these factories, since they are really close to water bodies, because they have to dump all their chemical waste, 70% of Chinese rivers at that point were polluted. So it's like these birds are just screwed like immediately, and they're going to be blamed on a virus. There's actually a quote from the Wetlands International Conservation Organization that said, there is no concrete proof that water birds of Xinhai that may have been infected with such a pathogenic strain and have survived will migrate and be capable of transmitting the virus to other species of birds, animals, or humans. So you do have a lot of organizations that see this for what it is, that are actually calling it out, but no one really pays attention to it because, again, the fear mongering is what, you know, gets people famous. Two more slides and I'm done. But between 2003 and 2024, it's said that there have been 887 cases of bird flu worldwide affecting humans, with 462 deaths. However, how are they diagnosing these cases? Primarily PCR and antibody tests. We know the whole thing with COVID and PCR and everything, not testing for anything. So it's easy to get people to look sick when they're not really sick with the virus.
Right. Or at the least, like if they're sick, again, they presuppose there's already a virus. They don't even look at other possible factors. And then they use PCR and they're able to, based on whatever the cycle threshold is, find whatever, especially with how the primers are created, just fragments of genetic material that are of unknown provenance, essentially, of unknown origin.
Exactly. And you just reminded me real quick, today there was out of Mexico a case of H5N2, I forget, death today, that it was a 59-year-old male. He had a lot of pre-existing conditions. He was bedridden for like 3 weeks prior. He had no connection to any poultry or any farms, any birds, any of that. Yet they tested him positive when he died for bird flu. And now he's being, you know, used as, you know, the way that this whole pandemic is supposedly going to start out of Mexico, which is absolutely ridiculous. It's asinine the way they keep, you know, cycling through this whole thing. So in this case where I mentioned the from 2003 to 2024, there are two different cases that came up of special importance to show you what exactly is happening here. Because, again, 462 deaths in two decades is literally, that's nothing at all. But people will ask, oh, well, are they really dying from bird flu? So let's look at the case. So one child in 2005 was diagnosed with pneumonia, and then later developed a fungal infection, you know, bioremediating agents, the fungus, and was told he had H5N1. He was given antibiotics, not good, a bunch of steroids and antivirals, one of those antivirals being Tamiflu, very well known, infamously, to be very toxic. And it's known to cause inflammation as well as inflammation in the brain, known as encephalitis, and have death as an adverse event listed. Yet, erroneously stated to be effective against avian flu, which is a whole nother topic. Tamiflu, and during this time, was shown that, oh, it's so effective against avian flu, with no evidence whatsoever. Same thing they did with remdesivir. Same thing we did with AZT. They did it with Tamiflu. So they gave this kid, this poor child, I believe he was like six, very young, of obviously developing pneumonia, all that stuff. They gave him all of these drugs, and lo and behold, he died. He died after intensive antiviral treatment. And if you know anything about antivirals, they're probably even more toxic than antibiotics. And this poor kid, who was already detoxing from something in his lungs, was given a bunch of allopathic remedies and then died. And then they say he died of H5N1. Another case, and also involving a child, I believe at this point he was like three or four, he had sore throat symptoms. He was given aspirin and antibiotics, and then later treated with a broad antibiotic coverage, which just means different antibiotics at a lot dosage in a short, very, very short period of time. The child ended up developing Reye's syndrome, which is swelling of the brain and the liver. This syndrome is listed directly associated with aspirin. He was given aspirin, and the boy unfortunately died. So H5N1 was labeled as the cause, even though that boy had not had any confirmed contact with birds. And at that point, there was yet to be any evidence of supposed human-to-human transmission of the bird flu. And that is just two cases of death of the 462, where they're killing the kids. They're just killing them in hospital, and they're saying it's the virus. Same thing they do with literally every other virus.
Well, and you think about that too, with just real quick on that one, with the kid receiving aspirin in this broad spectrum series of antibiotics. So the kid's receiving aspirin, which is super toxic to your liver, that's pretty well established at this point. But then you're also just destroying the microbial life inside your body that is now having to pleomorph, and they're unable to effectively do their role to bioremediate the toxicity of the aspirin. So the aspirin likely just overloaded his liver and overloaded his brain. I mean, it's pretty clear.
Yeah. All your detox organs are working overtime. They start shutting down. It gets acidified. And then the microbes are just like, okay, this kid's dying. We're just going to keep eating the dead tissue because it's just there's no use. And then they want to blame the germs. Stop blaming the germs for what they're naturally supposed to do. And stop blaming a virus because it's not there. The kids were killed by the doctors. And that is, that's a theme that I love to go into another time. But doctors are the main reason why people die in hospitals. So lastly, even with all of these shoddy studies, no isolated characterized particle, a very small number of cases, and a failed Tamiflu push that actually culminated in a very lucrative profit for Gilead, who developed remdesivir, and Roche, who also helped develop the PCR. So it's the same people doing the same thing over and over again. They're still pushing that, Tamiflu is supposedly effective for preventing this H5N1 virus or whatnot, even though a 2014 Cochrane report stated that Tamiflu was not effective at preventing the flu, and followed years later with another paper stating that Tamiflu can lead to dangerous adverse effects. Even after all of this, we're now having in 2024 yet another bird flu. So how do they do it this year? So an eye swab was shipped to the CDC and came back positive for avian flu. What were the symptoms of this person? The dude had eye irritation known as pink eye. In New York, we call it a sty, whatever it is. He had eye irritation. That's it. That's the only symptom he had. Was eye irritation, or a pink eye associated with the birds having bird flu? No, they had maybe discharge, but pink eye was never a symptom. And there's, again, never proof that birds can transfer this virus to humans. So what are we talking about exactly? And again, this happened around spring, summer of 2024. So allergies were not shown to even be a case in this, or, he worked on a farm. So what about dirt getting in his eye? He's living amongst animals. Something maybe got in his eye and he got irritated. Maybe there was a pesticide. They're not looking at any of this. They see he has eye irritation. He comes from a farm, a dairy farm, because they want to go after the raw milk and the cows and everything. Must be avian flu. Something, a symptom that can be experienced through a plethora of different issues. It was similar to a Texas case that the guy had the same symptom, eye irritation. Literally, that's it. We have two farmers in the entire nation of the United States that had pink eye on a farm, and they want to make a claim that this is the start of a pandemic. A nasal specimen from Michigan came back negative, even though they assumed that it was H5N1. It actually came back negative after conjunctivitis and flu-like symptoms from a farmer. That's it. The FDA claimed recently that pasteurized milk was found to contain H5N1 through sequences and egg inoculation tests, but they still state that pasteurized dairy was safe. The FDA then later stated in the same article that raw dairy is dangerous and has the possibility of bringing germs into you. It's just like, bro, give me a break. Like, on you want to push this whole pasteurization is really good for your milk, raw milk is dangerous, yet the whole H5N1 being found in the milk will invalidate Rivers and Koch's postulates that states that if you find those supposed disease-causing sequences or particles, then you should be sick. But now you're saying they're not going to be sick because it's pasteurized? So how do you know the virus is even in there in the first place? But with raw milk, oh no, that superfood is super deadly for you. And then they claim that they didn't give a number, they said several cats died from drinking raw milk after experiencing neurological symptoms, which honestly sounds to me like a scare piece. They did it recently with, I believe, Raw Milk Farm, the known brand. There was an entire hit propaganda piece. They were raided by government, and it turns out it was a made-up story. So they do that a lot with these raw milk farms. They do it all the time. They do it with farmers too, that don't want to follow the whole, you know, pesticide usage and all that. So they just attack them. So what we have here is two dairy workers in 2024 having conjunctivitis. And this is the cause for alarm. And how do they respond? So since, I believe since 2022, 92.3 million birds in the United States have been killed as a precaution due to supposed outbreaks. 92.3 million in less than 2 years have been killed. In Iowa alone, 4 million have been killed. So you have one or two positive, kill the rest of those chickens. One of which actually included, very famously, Minnesota Timberwolves owner, who actually suffocated 5.3 million chickens, which led to protest during NBA games. So this was well known for a long time. It's been well known. And in Texas now, recently, wastewater has come back positive in 9 cities for H5N1. They did the same exact thing with COVID. They were testing people's poop, testing people's, you know, waste in their water, using that as a way to say, stay home, you're sick with COVID, get this shot, or perpetuating the pandemic is still around. And recently, actually, the United States government pushed for a faster response by easing regulations for labs to test for H5N1. So there used to be a lot of loopholes you have, no, not loopholes, a lot of hoops you have to jump through to get testing done and accurately. They removed all of those holes to jump through in regulations. So now they just want to make it really easy for labs to get positive tests for H5N1. And when you do that with PCR, you're going to perpetuate a pandemic. What we have here is literally nothing happening. You have chickens getting sick from bad treatment. One of them gets tested with an erroneous test. And then you kill 90, 100 million different birds. And then you control the food system like that. You know, all these manufactured food shortages. Is it really that? Do we just run out of food, or are there nefarious powers controlling where we get our food from?
Right.
So, yeah, that's all I got. But nothing. Oh,
I mean, thank you so much for that, man. And what that causes in human beings is us to then latch on to these fear narratives. And then through psychosomatics, there's very clearly a possibility of bringing about actual physical symptoms of illness. This is a well-established phenomenon, I'd say, at this point, bringing about material results, physical symptoms of illness, just related to the idea that bird flu is spreading to humans and it's something worth being afraid of.
Exactly. Oh, real quick before I forget, I thought this was a cool point I added to the caption. Mike Stone wrote a great paper on Virology about avian flu, and it included, during that time, I think there were a couple influenza epidemics in China, and it talked about a doctor in America that read a report out of China talking about influenza or whatever. So he believed that it was a mixture of avian flu and some human influenza. So he developed a vaccine in America in around June, and he got a bunch of people to get the vaccine. 3 months later, in September, the flu magically appears in America, right? So did the flu actually go from China to America in less than 3 months, or did his vaccine that he made people get in June of that year lead to people developing illness and then leading to, I believe the number was 116,000 deaths that were labeled as influenza, but there was a max vaccination campaign that immediately prefaced it. So of course, they're not going to talk about the shots. They're not going to talk about the same thing with Spanish flu, was mass vaccinations. So I thought that was really interesting. So for people that are even thinking about getting the shot, don't. Whenever it comes out, just don't.
Right. Absolutely. And again, this just shows the importance of attacking the foundation of this whole paradigm, because they're going to continue to do this, continue to have new, quote, viruses pop up out of nowhere, and using, quote, sophisticated sequencing technologies, they'll be able to distribute these assembled genomes across the earth very quickly so that other labs in other places can begin testing chickens and other animals and people in those areas. And very quickly, you could have a totally artificial, totally nonsensical, not real, in reality, quote, pandemic on your hands just by creating these effects and buying into this whole nonsensical paradigm. So that's why it's important to focus on the root and not just focus on the need to stop vaccination. It's so much deeper than that. So with that, so the second half of this episode is an announcement of a very, very, I'd say one of the most important projects of the 21st century. And I don't say that lightly. Like I genuinely mean one of, if not the most important projects in the 21st century, especially with what we faced over the last 4 years. So I'm sure many of you who are listening or watching this are familiar with the experiments conducted by Stefan Lanka. Now, what we're going to discuss in the rest of this episode is related directly to that, but really taking the work of Stefan Lanka and expanding upon it. And in a way, taking all of the feedback and scrutiny that has been received based on Stefan Lanka's work. So, you know, virologists and pro-vaccine and pro-virology skeptics who have read some of Stefan Lanka's control experiments and criticized them for various quote errors. Now what we're discussing here is another set of control experiments that are being done to the highest level of scrutiny possible, you could say, with respect to this whole virology paradigm. Basically, taking Stefan Lanka's control experiments, expanding upon them, and taking all the feedback that has been received by virologists and saying, okay, we'll do it that way and see what happens. So I'm going to turn it over to my buddy, Jamie, who's going to describe some of these experiments that are being conducted right now. If you're enjoying this episode, please consider sharing it with at least one friend or family member who you think could benefit from hearing it. You help us grow and reach more people by sharing it with those around you. Also, be sure to head to the show notes to check out our membership offerings, membership marketplace, and more. We all know that big ag is poisoning our food supply, and big pharma's so-called medicine is straight up poison. What most people aren't aware of, though, is that most supplements are also filled with artificial sweeteners, dyes, GMOs, glyphosate, and a host of other toxic ingredients, even many of the more natural supplements. My good buddy James Benefico dedicated his life to crafting the world's cleanest, most nutritious organic supplements after a pre-workout energy drink caused heart palpitations so severe that he almost landed up in the ER. Organic Muscle was born, revolutionizing sports nutrition by using exclusively non-GMO ingredients from USDA organic farms. Since then, tens of thousands of people, including myself, have leveled up their fitness and their health with Organic Muscle's award-winning natural pre-workout. There's no jitters, no heart palpitations, no itchy skin, just nourishing organic food and herb-based ingredients for clean, sustained energy, strength, endurance, and recovery. Numerous studies have shown that tonka ali is the most effective herb in the world for naturally boosting testosterone levels. And we know that testosterone levels are depleting all over the world because of what's put in the food supply, what we're exposed to. Organic Muscle has the world's first fully organic tonka ali supplement. I only support and promote things that I actually use, and I can say I legitimately use Organic Muscle products. Use code FORWARD15 at checkout for 15% off at organicmuscle.com.
Hi, Alec. Thank you for having me on The Way Forward, and thank you for all of your support in doing this and making this possible, this project. You know, we've been talking over quite a few months, and we've actually been running this project for about 8 months behind the scenes. And it's nice to finally come and show some of the work that we've been doing, and talk to people through it, and to push this project forward, because I think that it's a project that has a lot of scope, not only within the areas of virology, but within a large amount of the fraudulent science that you see perpetuating these problems, not only within virology, but within say climate science, or as Jacob wonderfully outlined, within the food sources. They were doing the same thing in the UK with cattle, with BSE, and with sheep, with foot and mouth, where they culled 10 million of these sheep for all sorts of reasons. And I think it's important to attack the root cause of this, which is the science, you know, in quotation marks, in you know, the science TM. Really, there's a lot of there's a lot of periphery stuff that you have to learn about the science, but you know, to kind of get to the some of the problems that you know, the core essence of the problems. And really, one of the things that sparked my interest was seeing Dr. Lanker's work in 2021 when he released his control experiments, and realizing what the power of a control experiment was. You know, when you go back to your school days, I was a scientist at school. I did science. I did geology at university, and some of the core principles of science are just revolving around the control. You control for an environment, and if you can't make that independent variable do what you're saying, and we discuss even supposing that you have the independent variable, which within virology is not a given, but if you can control the environment and it does the same thing, the effect is the same without that independent variable, then you have falsified the entirety of the experiment. And a light turned on when I saw Stefan Lanker's control experiments, and it was simple to me that that's what needed to be done, not only for virology, but for all of these core principles of science. So I set about doing it 8 months ago. And in those 8 months, been working with three accredited labs in the US, conducting the most comprehensive control studies of the virological methodology ever done. I've been working hand in hand with 30-year experienced biochemists and geneticists, working in hired labs to not only replicate the results of Stefan Lanker, but go further. There was some contention that he did do a genetics part to it, but that was never released. So I wanted to follow on from his cell culture isolation, where they isolate a virus in a concoction of cell lines taken from humans and animals, fetal bovine serum to act as a nutrient source, and antibiotics to take away fungal and bacterial infections in these cell cultures, and they claim to grow viruses in them.
Can I jump in real quick, Jamie, just to describe where we're at so far? So for those who are brand new to this, I highly recommend checking out the episodes that I've linked in the show notes first. But with that being said, I'll give a brief summary in layman's terms as best I can. So what Jamie is describing is that in virology's cell culture isolation studies that they've done, claiming to isolate and subsequently show the pathogenicity of a said virus, what they do is they take a sample of snot that is relatively unpurified, add that to a foreign cell line amongst a bunch of other substances. The cells break down, experiencing what is called the cytopathic effect, into a bunch of fragments. They then take the byproduct of that and, with electron microscopy, produce electron micrograph images, point to the resultant particles, and claim that they are viruses. Now, when it comes to the control experiments that are done, the whole field of virology does not do adequate control experiments. First off, they presume, as Jamie said, that there is a virus present without ever validating that the virus or viruses are actually there in the first place, which means when we paint that against the scientific method, they assume that their independent variable, the presumed cause, is present, and they assume that that non-existent or never proven to exist independent variable is inside the sample and is causing the dependent variable, which is the effect, the observed effect, right? Which is the cytopathic effect that is experienced by the cells. Now, what Jamie is describing here is that the control experiments that are being done now, and as were done by Stefan Lanka, are doing the exact same procedure that virologists do. And now Jamie is and his team are doing it much more rigorously, the exact same steps, except for there is no sample present, meaning no possible source of a virus present, and the exact same results are found, meaning the exact same observed phenomenon. This is not a natural phenomenon, but nonetheless observed phenomenon, the exact same effects are caused without any possible source of a virus present, which then should lead one to ask, what is the true cause of this? And again, this is the foundational so-called evidence for the entire field of virology. So it is an incredibly, incredibly important thing that is being done here. I just wanted to jump in real quick, Jamie. Sorry about that. Just to explain.
No, that's right. Thank you for bringing that up. Often I get kind of carried away in the weeds, talking about some of the technical aspects of it. But it's not too difficult to wrap your head around once you get into the swing of it. And what we did was we took Stefan Lanka's work, and we heard a lot of the objections to it that people had online, and I surveyed a lot of people as well to find out, to try and steel man what is the science, because that they don't do that very often. They publish a paper and go, this, almost this is for granted. They say this work suggests this, or and there's no kind of rebuttal to it. It's all a kind of a game of just acceptance of and hierarchy. And so not only did we want to address their problems, but also moving forward with this project, we want to be able to address other people's projects with the science that we've put forward. So we took Stefan Lanka's work and some of the issues that he had said that he had. And not only did we replicate it once, we replicated it 12 times. Over nearly 90 cell cultures. So we did 90 cell cultures, and we chose a materials list that would provide the most strength to our cause, to our results. So usually a cell culture is taken for instance, for SARS-CoV-2. They use a Vero cell, which is a monkey kidney cell, which is actually quite a weak cell line. It's known to break down quite easily, and also is quite susceptible to some of the antibiotics. So we actually chose not to use a Vero-6 cell line. We chose to use a human embryonic kidney cell, which is the HEK293T cell line, unfortunately from the kidney of a human embryo. But that is known as one of the most robust cell lines, the hardest to break down. It is used in isolation of adenoviruses and things like that. And we also chose to use some of the weakest antibiotics, penicillin and streptomycin, rather than the more aggressive amphotericin and gentamicin, which are known renal toxins. So with the cell cultures, we were looking to create an environment that is the hardest to achieve what we thought we would achieve. I mean, obviously we wanted to set out in an objective manner, but we had some sort of indication, given Stefan Lanka's work, that this would happen, that basically when we were putting up putting cell cultures in, when you initially grow the cell culture out, you grow it in a 10% medium. So what happens is when you make the cell culture to start off with, you grow out a cell line. and you feed it nutrients. This fetal bovine serum here, you can see the FBS. That is something that the cell line likes. It grows in it. It feels comfortable in that environment. At 10%, these cell lines will grow out. And some of the issues that people had with Stefan Lanka's control experiments were that they said that he overgrew his cell line, i.e. he kept feeding them and kept feeding the cells until they reach 100% confluence. And when they become too full, they start to starve each other out. So they kill the cells adjacent to each other. We took that to note and grew them to a confluence that was not overgrowing them, that was not reaching full confluence before starting any of the procedures for supposed isolation, which is removing that fetal bovine serum. So when you remove the fetal bovine serum and take it down to 2% and eventually 1%, which is essentially starving, it's starving the cells. I mean, this is standard virological protocol where they remove the nutrients, add antibiotics, and then add a human sample of snot or bronchoalveoli fluid, from the lungs, which is where they say that when these holes, start to open up, this is the cell line dying because of what is in the sample that they've put in. Now, these controls show exactly that it cannot possibly be the addition of whatever is in the sample, because we added no sample. There is no sample whatsoever in this. This is free of any possibility of viral contamination, given that the products that are in there, the cell line is given via the ATCC with a negative test. So it is negative and free of any contamination when you buy the cell line, which we did. The heat, the fetal bovine serum is heat inactivated, so that that it is sterilized and contains no contaminants. And obviously the antibiotics are antibiotics. And so when you look at these cell lines, you can see from left to right, they're increasing doses of penicillin and streptomycin, the antibiotics. Now, we, with the lab, for many months, did a lot of research and development on these on these control experiments, going through exactly the protocols laid out in the way that you in the way that you handle cell cultures. The most comprehensive protocols are by the ATCC, who also provide some of the cell lines. It's a private organization, but they effectively write the rules and regulations on how to take care of these cell cultures by protocol, and we followed those to the T. So volumes, the amount of when to passage, which is when to regrow the cell lines, how much antibiotics to add, when to add them, so on and so forth. So here you can quite clearly see, and this is CPE. You can see where the cell line has died and moved away from, well, there are no cells there. It's a huge gaping hole. I mean, but we didn't just want to leave it, to opinion. We wanted to objectively verify that CPE was occurring in these results. So that's what we did. We used laser spectrometry via a machine called COUNTess, which counts the amount of viable cells within these cultures, i.e. cells that are live and cells that are dead. And if you look down here, you can see this readout, live and dead cells. So here, at just day four, we have received 44% dead cells, 44% cytopathic effect, apoptosis of cells, which when you cross-reference it with any paper, any published peer-reviewed paper, is a clear indication that a supposed virus is in these cultures. Now, there is no other way to describe it when you receive such, and we have received CPE to this level in every single experiment that we've done. All 12 of the cultures that we've ran have received CPE and objectively verified via countets between 30 and 44% at days 6, 5, and 4. And
to be clear, this is what virologists use to objectively claim that there was enough cell death to constitute this virus being a pathogenic agent, essentially.
Correct.
And if I can add something real quick, I really appreciate that you're almost giving the virologists, like, making it easy on them almost, because you're using a cell line that is very strong. I remember a study actually that Cowan had posted a long time ago where they used different cell lines, one of them being HUH, another one being Vero and whatnot. And then depending on the cell line, the weakest one would get the most CPE. So you're actually helping, not helping, but you're being as objective as possible here, purposely not using the weakest cell line. So you're not going to have them use an excuse that, oh, it's just a weak cell line. And I absolutely love that they're so picky with Stefan Lanka's control experiments. Imagine they were just as picky with Stefan Lanka's control experiments with virologists' experiments. Then people would see the big issues with this, especially with you not even using amphotericin. I've never seen a virologist study not use amphotericin. I mean, there's a couple. They're always using the weakest cell line, and they're always using the most toxic antibiotics and, you know, chemicals like formaldehyde, which you haven't even mentioned there. So this is almost like helping them in a case where you're not using all that stuff and you're still getting the same exact effect that we see. And you mentioned CPE. What I've talked to virologists about, they always say CPE equals virus. They always say that. Yet you don't have a virus here. It's just breakdown as a result of the toxic culture to make it easier.
Right. Thank you, Jacob, for pointing that out. Yeah, I think we wanted to give ourselves the highest hurdle so that the results mean more. You know, we wanted to take Lanka's work and keep going and keep it alive. And really, you know, it comes from some of the control experiments even further back in the 90s with Eleni Papadopoulos-Ioulopoulos, who did the same with HIV. But, you know, in these days of kind of being connected on a social level, it's it becomes easier as laymen to people like me to actually, you know, when Eleni was doing her control experiments, it was much harder to get it, you know, in contact with people and find these things. Nowadays, for me, just as a layman, it was no much more than phone calls, you know, phone calls and organizing and paying some money, you know, to organize the experiments that I wanted to see. You know, you can do this. You can approach CROs and independent labs, and if you know, you know, some of the language that you need to know and the experiments that you want to carry out, it's totally possible. You know, in this modern day and age, you know, that kind of system is you know, the system is harder to beat but easier to beat at the same time, right? On the screen is shared now our positive, our version of a positive control for the cell cultures, because we wanted to try and see what would happen, you know, because obviously we had no sample in there. So what we did to a percentage of these experiments, maybe about 10 or 15 of the cultures, is that we added human sputum to them, we spat in them. To act as a kind of positive control. To obviously we didn't know whether this person was you know, tested positive. They weren't tested before, but just to see the interaction of how an actual human sample would change, because they would say, you know, they would claim that there are millions of viruses floating around everywhere all the time. There are millions of bacteria and so on and so forth. So presumably this, you know, it should have done something. So we added sputum into this sample to see if it would affect the amount of CPE that we were receiving. And if you look down here again at the readout that we have, the objective verification of the amount of CPE occurring under exactly the same conditions, so day four supposed inoculation or day four past passage with 2% fetal bovine serum plus the sputum, we only get 35% CPE, which is around about the same, and it's actually slightly less. So we've received slightly less of the indicative signal that the virologists say that there is a virus within their culture than with no sample whatsoever. So again, that further suggests that it is just the ingredients of the cell culture which are dying because they are being starved of the fetal bovine serum and dying because they have toxic antibiotics added to them. And the more antibiotics you add to the culture and the longer you leave the cell lines to die, it's a living thing. It dies. And so now that we've shown you the cell death and the apoptosis within the cell line, we can go and look at how these cells look normally when they're grown within the with the 10% fetal bovine serum that is a nutrient source. So here you can see the 10% serum and the cell line is completely natural. You see no apoptosis, you see no ballooning, you see a healthy cell line that is complete. And so here we have, and you can see this in one movement between the two. So the 10% has stayed for 4 days at exactly the same time. It also has 1x penicillin and streptomycin. So this acts as almost our positive control. And here you can see where we've removed that fetal bovine serum. And then as we increase the antibiotics, you see, I mean, here it slightly decreases, but it's variable within the culture ever so slightly, but you see an increase in the amount of CPE that we've received up to 44%. So here you get exactly the contrast between live, happy, healthy cells and dead cells, and that is the removal of the fetal bovine serum. At exactly the same day, in post-passage, there is no cell death within within this culture at 10% fetal bovine serum. Whereas if you look at this apoptosis and cell death within the culture that has the fetal bovine serum removed, at exactly the same days, day two, it starts to break down towards day four. So you see this progression as soon as the fetal bovine serum is removed. You start to see the cells dying day two, day three, and here we see the cells at day four.
In the significance of this, Jamie, please correct me if I'm wrong, is that when virologists are conducting these cell culture isolation experiments, they are reducing the nutrient intake down to 2%. There's some variation depending on the the experiment, but in general, they reduce it down to 2% fetal bovine serum. And again, they're claiming
1%. Yeah.
Or 1%.
Yeah.
Right. So the point here is what you're showing, just to reiterate to the audience, especially for those who are just listening, is what Jamie showed is that with 10% fetal bovine serum, there was no cytopathic effect, even through day four in the culture. But with 1 or 2% fetal bovine serum at day four, there was a significant amount of cytopathic effect in the culture. And that's irrespective of antibiotic use. That's just manipulating and varying the amount of fetal bovine serum that is used. So again, the significance there is tremendous. It's showing that just by manipulating the nutrient amount given to these cells, you can elicit a cytopathic effect at day four. And again, this is an objective cytopathic effect. It is visible to the naked eye with these microscope images, but the point is, let me be clear, visible not to the naked eye, but with the microscope. The point here, though, is that this is an objective cytopathic effect. This is not based on someone's interpretation. This is using the COUNTess machine that we described earlier to verify the number of cells that are viable versus the number of cells that have died. So this is an objective cytopathic effect that is, again, being elicited based on just changing the nutrient concentration in the culture. So that is extremely significant when it comes to them claiming that the cytopathic effect in these cultures is the result of viruses that they presume are there based on a sample. And again, in these experiments that are being done by Jamie and his team, there is no possible source of a virus or viruses present because there is no sample, showing that the effects that they point to and claim are caused by viruses cannot possibly be caused by viruses because they are caused just by manipulating the nutrient concentration and manipulating the amount of antibiotics and the concentration of antibiotics and antimycotics that are used.
Exactly. And we've shown this within numerous, 12 times, exactly the same results and repeatable results. And I would encourage other people to do the same, to replicate and repeat our results as we did Lanka's. But we wanted to go further, and we have. And in a world first, we have done a control experiment, taken those same cultures, and we have put them under the microscope because, one of the problems, that we always come up against with people when it comes to the virus part of it is, you can see a virus is the shout, is the claim, but you can see one under a microscope. Duh, it's as if because they point to these things within transmission electron microscopy and point to these round things that, virologists say are viruses, it's quite a difficult one to explain. And until now, we've only really had a few control experiments, such as there was a paper in 2020, which was called Negative Renal COVID-like viral-like inclusions in negative renal biopsies, which is where they did kidney biopsies of people that tested negative, and they found, lo and behold, things that looked identical to what they claim SARS-CoV-2 particles look like. And they had to do a bit of a double track and say, you have to be careful. You have to be careful of looking at these things. But apart from that, there's not a lot of science out there that breaks down the microscopy part of it. So that's what we did.
Just to be clear on that, Jamie, I want to emphasize this for those who are skeptical that are listening or watching. It's not you conducting these experiments. You've just become proficient in understanding what's going on, and you're just the spokesperson. You're the mouthpiece, so to speak. It's that you are using accredited labs, and you are using people who are proficient and trained and credentialed in these fields of study that are doing these things, what would be considered proper control experiments on all of virology's key, quote, lines of evidence, correct?
That's That's 100% correct. I contacted a lab to a CRO, an independent lab, to carry out the transmission electron microscopy that we did on the cultures. We gave them a brief for what to look at, because we've been slightly funds prohibited with this, so we didn't elect to take a package that would allow us to quote look for viruses, because there would have to be all sorts of health and safety measures to do with handling these things. So we got them to try and look for extracellular vesicles, these vesicles within a cell line which bud off, empty vesicles, because we knew that our mythical particles would be somewhere near to where these cells are budding off, and as they die, they bud off and move away. So we directed this CRO to look in these particular areas, fingers crossed that we would also see some of our culprits. We also, unfortunately, were limited again by what we could look at. One of the packages that they offered allowed us to, whilst they were under the microscope, they have to fix the sample in a particularly noxious substance and then put it under transmission electron microscopy. But one of the packages allowed us to look at whilst live under the microscope and direct them as to what we wanted to look at and how many pictures we wanted to take. It was kind of quite a few dozen, I think, that they would have allowed us to take. Unfortunately, funds prohibited us in doing that, so we got just 9 images that were completely at their behest of what they wanted to look at. So let's,
we're going to cover the funding issues later on, because there is going to be a call to action for those that are listening or watching and want to help what I'm calling the most important project of the century. That's the title for this episode, because it really is the most important project of this century. So if you'd like to help with the funds, please head to the show notes and head to the donate page below to help out with this project. And we'll cover that again later on. I just wanted to bring that up right here.
No, thank you, Alec. We are pushing on, and I hope that people, can see by the end of it that, we have a larger project at play, and we really want to pull every aspect of virology apart and also answer people's questions. And we also have a product to give people at the end of this, which is all of this scientific data for people to have and to own and to use in their own capacity. We're open sourcing all of this science and all of this data for you to have. I'll explain a little bit more at the end, but any donations towards this project will be put towards growing it and towards finding out some of this very important information that we're finding out now. So if you, I'm sharing at the moment what this CRO has positively identified as an extracellular vesicle. So this was their brief to look under the microscope and find extracellular vesicles. Now you can tell that it's misshapen, it's completely empty, and you can't see on the scale here, but I will tell you that it's much, much larger than most of the viruses that we've seen, at about 2,000 nanometers. So you can quite clearly tell this is not anything that could be described as a virus, which will become important as we look through some of the other images. We know that these extracellular vesicles, and it is accepted within the scientific community that these are just budding off lipid surrounded bubbles that come away from dead and dying cell lines. This is an image from the CDC outlining exactly what they believe SARS-CoV-2, the Omicron variant, looks like. So note its round shape, note its inclusions within here, these dark spots within here. Note how many, and also look at all the other particles that are in the vicinity that they are claiming is SARS-CoV-2. So note that they're not all identical, but they're roughly similar. Okay, so this is the transmission electron microscopy from our culture. Note this round looking particle with exactly the same of these inclusions in it, with exactly the same surrounding. They say the capsid surrounding. This is found within a culture with no human sampling, with no possibility of a virus being included in it. Okay. This, we have cross-referenced this with size. So this is 140 nanometers, and I'll run through it as well. We're given an estimate of SARS-CoV-2 being between 80 and 140 nanometers in size, and this is exactly the same size at 140 nanometers. So here is the zoomed out image that we got direct from the CRO, and on here you can see the size chart. So here, if you notice, the amount of pixels, you can, if you point and drag, you can see there's so many pixels here. So you can get a rough estimate of how wide, how large these particles are by reading off of here. So if you see, the 500 nanometers is roughly 70 pixels wide on here. And if you come over to SAR, this particle that looks identical to SARS-CoV-2, you'll see that kind of roughly 15, 16, something like that. So we're talking 130 nanometers as read off by the scale, 130, 140 nanometers, which is exactly the same size as touted by the CDC of what SARS-CoV-2 should look like.
And the important thing there, real quick, Jamie, for those that are listening and unable to see the images, and I highly suggest that you watch the video version of this episode rather than listen in, because it's just so important to see these images. But for those who are listening, what Jamie just showed is a CDC image of what is allegedly the Omicron variant of SARS-CoV-2, right? And then Jamie showed the TEM images from their experiment, the control experiments, with no possible source of SARS-CoV-2 present, with the exact same particles, virtually indistinguishable, same morphological appearance, and the same size as what is alleged to be SARS-CoV-2 by the CDC. Same appearance, same size, no possible sample of SARS-CoV-2 present.
But wait, there's more.
So here we go. We have the CDC's image of what they call measles, and where SARS is you know, a round blob with these particles in, you know, 100 with, they don't label any of the particles inside it. Here they do with measles. It's quite clearly oval in shape, and they even go as far to point out these specific parts, and they label them phosphoproteins and large proteins, and they show that there's a viral membrane around, and there's a very distinctive oval shape, and it's also a lot larger than SARS-CoV-2, or supposed SARS-CoV-2. It's about 250 nanometers. Now, if we come to our culture here, we see an oval shape with these specifically dotted proteins, and we could label them proteins and phosphoproteins, exactly the same as the CDC have labeled them. You can see something that looks identical to the inclusions, the size, in general, oval, and also the shape oval, and also the size. It is exactly 250 nanometers in size, and we can read that off of the scale just to show you as well, because I think it's important. Here we are. So here's our supposed measles virus. If we take the bar scale, I'm not zoomed in a lot here, but we've got about 310, something like that, for 500 nanometers. If you take it from the largest point and extend it, you're talking 160 from tip to tip, and 322. So that's exactly 250 nanometers in size, exactly the same as the CDC say that the measles virus is. Same shape, that oval shape, with the same protein inclusions. Don't even know if they're proteins, you know, or not, but they've pointed to these things and labeled them as proteins and phosphoproteins, and been very specific about them. And don't forget that this is within just 9 photos that we had no control over, absolutely no control. We said, take pictures of these. They gave us 9 back. 3 of those were just of the extracellular vesicles. And if we could just go back to talking about those extracellular vesicles, because they have pointed out that these cannot be extracellular vesicles. So what are they?
Right. So what that sounds like to me is that there must have been a ghost virus that just popped up inside your sample of measles, of SARS-CoV-2 Omicron variant. And it's absurd because I'm sure someone would somehow try to claim that just to reify this whole paradigm. But what's crystal clear based on what you're showing thus far is that without any possible source of any type of virus present whatsoever, you're getting the exact same morphological appearance of these particles at the exact same sizes of what the CDC and other health institutions are calling viruses. The exact same thing without any source present.
To add what you said, Alec, it's totally true that people will try to justify this and say there must have been a virus there you didn't check for. They did the same thing. I believe these were control experiments done after John Enders in the 50s, where he would do this, you know, similar stuff with cells, and they would break down without added stuff in it. But they said it must be a virus from the cell itself, not from a sample. And then they call it SV40 or something.
Right.
Where people are now making claims that, oh, monkey virus is in vaccines, when it's just from the kidney cell. It's not a virus. So what you said there is very actually possible. People will try to make that claim.
Right. Yeah. What is your response to that, Jamie? If people try to claim that these viruses, they must be viruses, and they must just be coming from the cell, from the human embryonic kidney cell line.
I mean, this is the whole point of a control, is that when you are given, when you buy the cell line, the reason why, and these cell lines are not cheap, when you buy these cell lines that cost, you know, nearly $1,000 for, you know, what is a vial of monkey kidney. The reason why they cost so much is because there's a thing called chain of custody, and chain of custody ensures that what you have is a, you know, a purified sample with zero contaminants that has been refrigerated down to sub-zero temperatures at all stages, at all times, and free from contaminants. And, you know, to kind of expand on that a little bit, and I don't want to take too long, is that the thing that I'm suggesting with these control experiments is that, you know, when we start to look at a lot of science, you know, and pull it apart, a lot of it is fraudulent, and a lot of it is a waste of time, and it's complete, you know, it's complete fantasy land stuff. But I also disagree with chucking the whole of science out. We're just going, right, just get rid of it all. I think that, you know, the infrastructures around science, and there are people, you know, with it working within the scientific realm that you know, haven't forgot what it's about. There are systems and structures and protocols, and the scientific method is there for truth finding, really. It's just that not many people use it anymore. You know, that simple and core premise around science, the scientific method, you know, you'd be surprised at just how many people don't use it anymore. But, you know, I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater with this. I want to redirect people's energy and focus towards finding the truth using some of these fail safes, I guess you could call them, such as, you know, control studies where you can say that when you receive a cell line, you know that it is, you know, negative and free of contaminants, which is why these control studies showing these things are so important, because they very strongly suggest that the things that they're calling viruses are not viruses, because they're found in cultures that can't possibly contain a virus. So I'll move on, and we're looking at these HIV. You know, it supposedly killed many hundreds of thousands of people, I think. You know, and all of these extremely horrible drugs given to people, which also killed people, AZT. And, you know, the damage that it did to social cohesion, to, you know, telling people that if you had sex with other people, you could kill them with this sexually transmitted disease. This tiny little fried egg looking thing is supposedly HIV, according to the CDC. If you look, it's spherical in shape. They're all roughly spherical, a few misshapen, but the most identifiable characteristic for HIV is this nucleus in here, the single nucleus of, again, proteins or some sort of, I don't know what they technically call that part, but, you know, we can look at it and describe it as a fried egg type or nucleus type body. And this is ranging between 80 and 100 to 110 nanometers in size.
So either this is all BS or that was the sickest cell line in history. You're getting every single virus from these cell lines.
If you can see our cell, what do we have here? This round nucleated cell, fried egg type thing with a conglomeration of you know, whatever it is that they're saying is in here, protein something, but we can describe what it is: a round looking nucleated cell that is exactly the same size. It's 100 nanometers as read off of the scale. So as Jacob has said, just within the 9 images that we've taken in our first try, it's not as if we, you know, have scoured up and down the country and we've put every 90 cell cultures in. We've done one with 9 pictures and found 3 of the main, you know, viruses. Measles, that, you know, they have mandated MMR jabs in quite a lot of European countries for school children. We found HIV, which, you know, led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of innocent people. We found SARS-CoV-2, which is the reason probably why we're all sat here, you know, because of the death and destruction that occurred, you know, from 2020 till now. And so this leads me up to the next part, is that we don't want to stop there, because virologists unfortunately don't stop there either. Is that they say, and as they did with the paper before, before that I mentioned before, COVID-like inclusions and negative renal biopsies, they say, there are identical particles that look like it. What you have to do is verify them with genetics. All roads lead to the PCR confirmation and full transcriptomics. And this is where we're up to with this project. 8 months in is that we have this data. We want to share this data with you, but we want it to be complete. We want to overturn every single stone that has to do with the virological methodology so we can put it to bed. And this is the project that I'm running to move forward. And this is really where I'm asking for your help, because thus far it's been funded privately, and it's taken us this far. But the next step that we want to look at is PCR and full transcriptomics. So we're going to take those cultures. We're going to, again, employ CROs to fully sequence the genomics of these cultures. And we're going to PCR test these control cultures by sending them off to numerous genetics labs to cross-reference the results that we get back to find out what we get. Also, I want to purchase a PCR machine to really pull a qPCR, real-time PCR machine, which is industry standard to use. I want to purchase a machine to use with a geneticist that I've been working with, a seasoned geneticist, to find out what's going on within these realms, because we know that, you know, something funky is up. We know that there's a problem because we're not seeing these results. I mean, I could talk quite a lot about the genetics part of what. But, you know, when you look at the outputs of genetics, when you actually scrutinize the accuracy of these genetics tests, there was a chap called Barry Sheck who was part of the O.J. Simpson forensics team, and he was so disgusted at the lack of accuracy within the forensics within the forensics data that's been shared as part of the trial, that he started his own company called the Innocence Project, or the Innocence Group. And they actually forced the three-letter agencies to do with genetics testing to show them any sort of, what would you call it, a blinded accuracy study. So where you have a pool of genetic samples and you ask them, a geneticist, to find a particular sample that you know that is blinded to them. So, you know, if you want to say, I have a pool of 100 animals, I pick an animal, you tell me, you sequence its genetics and tell me what animal I have. Now, he did this with 107 different labs with criminal cases, with humans. He gave 107 different labs a mixed sample, three samples, and said, can you find the perpetrator within just this sample of three samples? And six labs got the right answer. Six out of 107 labs, which is less than 10%, less than a good guess of blinded accuracy studies with PCR, which is, you know, with genomic sequencing. And you know, I've searched high and wide, and I've had lots of conversations with you know, seasoned geneticists online asking for these simple blinded accuracy studies. Could you do this? You know, I've spoken to at least 100 where I've asked the same question. If I had 100 animals and I took the saliva of one of them and gave them to you, could you tell me what animal that is? Every single one of them says, of course I could. And I said, is there a study showing a simple blinded accuracy study like this? And they disappear because there aren't any it's a really silly, you know, silly thing, but this is how they get away with it, is that there are no accuracy studies. They claim that it's 99.9% accurate, but when they actually put it to the sword and when they actually put it to the test, it's less than 10%, less than a good guess. So what I'm doing with this project is I want to pull this end of the road, the end of the road, which is the PCR test, which is how, as Jacob, you know, described it so eloquently before with the bird flu, how they are fabricating these pandemics is using these PCR tests to claim that these people are infected with something and introducing all sorts of severe and totally ridiculous politics on top of them. So the project that I'm running is looking to start a small lab with PCR equipment to fully blow this open. And it would mean the world to us to have donations to be able to continue on these control experiments and to put towards finding out once and for all. And here's what we plan to do after we have collected this data, the PCR, the proteomics. We would also like to do protein studies, proteomics and antibody studies. That shouldn't be too difficult. LFT in a peer-reviewed study tested positive with water. So I'm just bottled water. I don't think it will be too difficult, that one. That's not going to take a lot of crowdfunding, but you know, what we're going to do is once we have all of this data, we are going to open source it. Now, I've spoken in depth with a couple of lawyers who have clarified that if you open source a scientific document, anybody is allowed to use that data, that science, and appropriate it as their own. They can use it, they could release it, publish it, they could self-publish it, they could use any of the data and amalgamate it in a scientific document, or they could use it in a legal capacity. And this is what we want to give you. Anybody that's followed some of the court cases to do with virology have maybe been able to note that there have been some notable ones I know in the UK where people have tried to take a government to court about the lockdown, trying to stop the lockdown, and have lost based on asymptomatic transmission being a thing. They've had these things, you know, quashed and thrown out at court. Now, not a lot of many people know that people have been winning in court. Stefan Lanka notably won, where they had to admit there was no scientific proof that the measles virus existed, to the tune of €100,000 prize money that he offered. He won in court. Martin Haviland won in court based on no virus when he showed the proof that there is no virus, because he was accruing €30,000 worth, I think it was, of mask fines. I mean, it's quite funny. Imagine him walking around, you know, kind of tapping policemen on the shoulder. Hey, look, I'm wearing no mask, to try and generate these costs. And then eventually, you know, when stood up in court, he had all of the fines quashed because they can't tackle the no virus claims, because control studies are legally binding. And this is where I want to give, this is what I want to give you, is we want to be able to offer this to you, to give you all of this science. So if they try and run with another pandemic where they, you know, say that ducks are going to kill you or whatever, you know, with the bird flu, then, and we want to give it to people, you know, in those jobs where they're trying to mandate you wear a mask at work, or you take a jab at work, or where you're trying to travel cross borders nationwide, and they're trying to say that you have to either show a PCR test or anything like that. We want to empower people with the science and with the law on their side, saying that people can present these documents to a border guard, to their employers, and say, this is scientific evidence that you have no virus here, that your PCR test does not show this, that there is no you have no virus here. And so that's where we're going with this project, is that ultimately we want to give this away to empower people to be able to operate and to be able to undo all of the political machination, so that 2020 never occurs again, which is the reason why I'm sat here, which is the reason why I'm doing this, is to make sure that, you know, here in France, it was bad. You know, I don't know what it was like with you guys in the US, but, you know, for nearly a year, my son, you know, wasn't allowed to go to football practice. He wasn't allowed to go to a restaurant. He wasn't allowed to go to a commercial soft play center because we had a vaccine passport here. And that will never happen again as long as I live, because it's the most atrocious thing that I've ever been a part of. And, you know, I want to empower people to undo those things if ever they try them again.
The project that you're doing, Jamie, is so unbelievably important. It cannot be overstated. And for those who are watching or listening that feel inclined to donate to Jamie's project, please head to the link in the show notes. And then we will be sending out a document on Jamie and his team's behalf afterwards for those who join our totally free mailing list. There's no gimmick. There's nothing, no cost to you. Just sign up for our newsletter. That will also be the link in the show notes. So those are the two calls to action for you. And then the third one would be, please, please, please share this with as many people as you possibly can. Again, if we want the medical tyranny to end, we want the entire agenda of the World Health Organization and these other tyrannical organizations to be discontinued, no longer able to go on, this is the way to do it. No longer whacking at the branches of an ever-growing tree, we are now cutting the tree down at its foundation. This is the foundational so-called evidence for the entire field of virology that has led to all of this medical tyranny over the years. And this is the way to end it for good. And I want to give a shout out to the scientists as well that Jamie is working with. I've had the chance to talk with a few of them, and these are some brave, brave, brave men and women that Jamie is working with, and that cannot be overstated as well. These people are, not only are they totally going against the whole paradigm that they were indoctrinated to believe, but they are doing it in a very big way. They are helping Jamie in conducting these proper control experiments to show the entire field that they were indoctrinated to believe in, and the entire field that has all of the money, all of the pharmaceutical backing, all of the government backing, et cetera, is totally fraudulent to its core. And these are some of the bravest men and women. You know, I come from the US military, I was in the army. And when people thank me for my service, I just laugh because I've shared this a number of times on this show. You know, my stance, if you've listened for a while on the military and on the government in general, the real people that we should be thanking for their service are people like Jamie and the scientists that are nameless and faceless behind the scenes for now, for obvious reasons, that are doing this incredible, incredible work in order to completely upend this whole false pseudoscientific paradigm. So definitely please be praying for these people, send positive energy their way, whatever you need to do to help us continue in this direction, to really come back to a true understanding, or begin to discover, scratch the surface of a true understanding of what health and the human body is capable of. And that's what we're doing in breaking down these false paradigms first. So with that, Jamie, again, thank you so much, brother, for doing this project. We've been talking about this for some time, and I've been sort of just cheering you on, and I am now feel so blessed to be directly involved. Obviously, as you know, this is something that is near and dear to my heart and very important to me. I've devoted a lot of time to educating people on virology. So this is the final nail on the coffin, let's say. And we've gotten two of the four primary pieces of evidence, so-called evidence, for virology totally exposed. So let's help Jamie and get him some more funds so we can expose the final third and fourth pieces. And thank you again for those who are watching, and be sure to share this with your friends and family. Make this go viral, pun intended.